Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on our weekly roundtable, updates and analysis as Democrats make their closing arguments for impeaching Donald J. Trump. And the Organization of American States. What is it? What was it founded to do? And why is it a tool for U.S. domination of the Americas? What does it have to do with destabilizing Central and Latin America and the Caribbean region? Also, the climate catastrophe. As huge swaths of Australia burns, world leaders meeting in Davos had to face young environmentalist Greta Thunberg. And two major U.S. banks, including J.P. Morgan, along with BlackRock, a private equity company that is the largest private equity in the world, have warned that ignoring the environmental crisis will disrupt economies around the world. They call for transitioning to a low-carbon economy. But is it enough? Our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Chicano activist, author, and environmentalist Bill Gallegos. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandiri. Democratic House prosecutors will focus on the second article of impeachment in their third and final day of arguments in the Senate trial of President Donald Trump. They'll walk through the many ways Trump obstructed the congressional investigation into his attempts to pressure Ukraine's president to investigate his political opponents. Yesterday, the House managers argued that Trump abused power for his own political benefit ahead of the 2020 election, even as the nation's top FBI and national security officials were publicly warning against the theory that it was Ukraine, not Russia, that interfered in the 2016 election. At the close of the evening, lead prosecutor, House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff, made an emotional plea to senators to consider what's at stake. Schiff quoted former Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who testified to the House that he came forward because, quote, right matters. Schiff said the Constitution alone can't protect the country against presidential abuse, and right matters and truth matters. Otherwise, Schiff said, we are lost.
No Constitution can protect us. Right doesn't matter anymore. And you know, you can't trust this president to do what's right for this country. You can trust he will do what's right for Donald Trump. He'll do it now. He's done it before. He'll do it for the next several months. He'll do it in the election if he's allowed to. This is why, if you find him guilty, you must find that he should be removed.
Trump's legal team is expected to begin presenting its defense on Saturday. Trump bemoaned in a tweet today, "Looks like my lawyers will be forced to start on Saturday, which is called Death Valley in TV." President Trump will take the stage to address the March for Life today. He'll become the first sitting U.S. president to address the annual anti-abortion crowd. Last year, he addressed the marchers via video. It's his latest gesture to the white evangelical voters who've proven to be among his most ardent supporters. Ralph Reed, chair of the Faith and Freedom Coalition and one of Trump's most prominent evangelical supporters, said his appearance would energize and remind pro-life voters what a great friend this president and administration has been. Reed added that voters who are pro-life love Donald Trump, and they will crawl across broken glass to get him reelected. Trump's sincerity on the issue is open to question. In a 1999 interview, he described himself as, quote, very pro-choice. That was well before he ran for president. China is swiftly building a hospital in Wuhan dedicated to treating patients infected by a new virus that has killed 26 people, sickened hundreds, and spread around the world. Chinese authorities expanded their lockdown to at least 13 cities with a combined population of 36 million people. At least 8 hospitals in Wuhan, the epicenter of the outbreak, issued public calls for donations of masks, goggles, gowns, and other protective medical gear. The World Health Organization decided against declaring the outbreak a global emergency for now. Spokesman Tarek Jasarovich said health officials are investigating potential antiviral treatments and the potential of vaccines to treat the pneumonia-like virus, but those efforts are still just first steps.
So this is work that is being done. So we are working really with our networks to try to understand the virus, try to see how diagnostics could be done, to see what works and what doesn't. But we are still at the early stage.
In the U.S., health officials are trying to determine whether a Texas A&M University student is the second known case of the virus in this country. The student recently returned from Wuhan. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists says its doomsday clock has moved to the closest point to midnight in its 73-year history. The group cited the existential danger from nuclear war and climate change and saying the clock now stands at 100 seconds to midnight. Former California Governor Jerry Brown is the executive chair of the Bulletin. He urged politicians and the public to wake up and take action.
We are in a predicament because the power that mankind has generated is completely at variance with the seriousness with which it's understood. Well, the moment is serious. Let us not let the moment pass. Each one of us can do something. The world is not over. We have incredible opportunity to reverse the nuclear arms race, the carbon emissions, and the headlong rush to ever more dangerous technology.
The wildfires raging in Australia since last fall may contribute as much as 2% to the overall rise of heat-trapping carbon in the atmosphere this year. The British Met Office says the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide is likely to rise to 417 parts per million by May. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. It is our weekly roundtable, and I'd like to welcome our panelists. Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program based in Mexico City. She is a regular contributor to Counterpunch, America's Updater, Foreign Policy in Focus, Fortune, and several Spanish language publications. Laura Carlson is also a television host and commentator on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues for various international news outlets. Laura Carlson, welcome.
Thanks very much, Margaret.
And Jackie Goldberg, governing board member for the Los Angeles School Board District 5. She is a former member of the California State Assembly and had previously served as a member of the Los Angeles City Council. Before being elected to the council, she served on and was later president of the Los Angeles School Board. Jackie Goldberg, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Bill Gallegos, longtime Chicano liberation and environmental justice activist. He is the author of The Sunbelt Strategy and Chicano Liberation and Reflections on the Green Economy. He's the former executive director of Communities for a Better Environment, one of the leading environmental justice organizations in the U.S. He recently authored an article entitled Ethnic Cleansing, a Program of Resistance. Bill Gallegos, welcome.
Buenos dias. Thank you, Margaret.
Okay, we're going to start out today with impeachment. And just to bring our listeners along, I'll do an introduction, play a clip, and then we'll have you all weigh in. Thursday, January 23rd, marked day 3 of the ongoing impeachment trial of Donald J. Trump, with House Democrats continuing to dismantle his major defenses. Thursday's session began with an in-depth seminar by Representative Jerry Nadler, one of the main House managers, on the framers of the Constitution's intent regarding impeachment. He presented a series of historical clips and quotations asserting that a crime need not have been committed to justify the impeachment trial. Following Nadler's presentation, a series of House prosecutors went on to place Trump's behavior into a framework of impeachable offenses. Representative Adam Schiff, the lead House manager, went on to debunk the idea that Trump withheld military aid from Ukraine and sought to investigate Joe Biden simply to root out corruption in the Ukraine. Using Trump's own words in interview clips, Schiff pointed out that he, Donald Trump, didn't care about corruption. He cared only about himself. Adam Schiff further asserted that Trump didn't learn from the Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, saying, quote, he was at it again. During the remainder of Thursday's session, Democrats focused on the first of two charges against Donald Trump, that he abused his power by trying to compel a foreign power to help him win re-election in 2020 and withheld two official acts, including the provision of $391 million in military aid and a White House meeting with the Ukrainian President Zelensky. On Friday, January 24th, Democrats expect to wrap up their case with presentations aimed at proving the second charge, that Trump obstructed Congress by withholding documents and witnesses and otherwise working to conceal his behavior. The managers will continue to deliver their arguments until the remainder of their allotted 24 hours expires or they decide to wrap up their case. On Saturday, Trump's defense team and the Republicans are set to go on the offensive, laying out their case against the charges. Despite rumors about a potential witness trade deal in which each party could call on witnesses of interest, it seems that such a deal is unlikely. Democrats are still holding out the hope that witnesses will be heard. According to the New York Times, Senate Democrats privately expressed concern that they may not get the four Republican votes they would need to bring witnesses, however, as well as documents into the trial. This despite Senator Chuck Schumer of New York saying he's cautiously optimistic that enough Republicans will vote to call witnesses like John Bolton, Trump's former national security advisor. On Saturday, Trump's defense is set to begin at the usual 1 p.m. Eastern time. Let us go now to hear an impassioned Adam Schiff speak to the senators.
Okay, he's guilty. Okay, he's guilty. Does he really need to be removed? Does he really need to be removed? We have an election coming up. Does he really need to be removed? He's guilty. You know, is there really any doubt about this? I mean, do we really have any doubt about the facts here? Does anybody really question whether the president is capable of what he's charged with? No one is really making the argument Donald Trump would never do such a thing. Because of course we know that he would, and of course we know that he did. It's a somewhat different question, though, to ask, okay, it's pretty obvious, whether we can say it publicly or we can't say it publicly, we all know what we're dealing here with this president. But does he really need to be removed? And this is why he needs to be removed. Donald Trump chose Rudy Giuliani over his own intelligence agencies. He chose Rudy Giuliani over his own FBI director. He chose Rudy Giuliani over his own national security advisors. When all of them were telling him this Ukraine 2016 stuff is kooky, crazy Russian propaganda, he chose not to believe them. He chose to believe Rudy Giuliani. That makes him dangerous to us, to our country. That was Donald Trump's choice. Now, why would Donald Trump believe a man like Rudy Giuliani over a man like Christopher Wray? Okay? Why would anyone in their right mind believe Rudy Giuliani over Christopher Wray? Because he wanted to, and because what Rudy was offering him was something that would help him personally. And what Christopher Wray was offering him was merely the truth. What Christopher Wray was offering him was merely the information he needed to protect his country and its elections. But that's not good enough. What's in it for him? What's in it for Donald Trump? This is why he needs to be removed. Now, you may be asking, how much damage can he really do in the next several months until the election? A lot. A lot of damage. It doesn't matter how good the Constitution is. It doesn't matter how brilliant the framers were. It doesn't matter how good or bad our advocacy in this trial is. It doesn't matter how well written the oath of impartiality is. If right doesn't matter, we're lost. If the truth doesn't matter, we're lost. Framers couldn't protect us from ourselves if right and truth don't matter. And you know that what he did was not right.
Wow, an impassioned Adam Schiff there. Laura Carlson, starting with you. I'll have to say he has stood out among the House managers in this and even earning a handshake from Lindsey Graham. Not that that means anything, but setting that aside, Laura Carlson, your thoughts on how the trial has been going thus far, and any thoughts on the issue of witnesses? I mean, Portside has published an article that says an impeachment trial without witnesses would be unconstitutional. I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion, legal discussion on it. But how is that looking? And also, given the fact, Laura Carlson, you're based south of the border, that the U.S. runs around the world, you know, touting itself as the world's leading democracy, and the whole world is watching this trial, which seems to be far from democratic process. Laura Carlson.
Yeah, Margaret, I think the process so far in these days that we've seen the Democratic managers lay out their case, it's been very systematic and quite solid. Because of the way that the procedure is set up, and also because of the way the media has reacted or not reacted, it's clear that this process lacks the drama of the Nixon case, which ended in resignation rather than impeachment, or even of the Kavanaugh case, but there's so much at stake. We're talking about, as Schiffer pointed out, we're talking about abuse of office for personal reasons, for personal political reasons, and that's precedent-setting. It's not only abuse of office by any person, but by a president who's clearly an aspiring autocrat and who is openly a white supremacist and a defender of the darkest ages of the patriarchy. So when we say it's not right, what he's done is not right, it's an important call to come back to some of those basic values, not get lost in the weeds of the bureaucracy or the decisions. And again, as you mentioned, ask the question, what kind of democracy do we want, or are we willing to fight for democracy itself? Across the world, people are following it very closely. There's pretty extensive coverage of the procedure itself, but still a kind of a wait-and-see attitude in terms of what comes out of it, with the clear understanding that a vote for impeachment is not on the horizon, and that this has to do with the elections. The decision, or the lack of a decision so far on witnesses, is one of the big points, of course, that we'll see coming up in addition to how the Republicans lay out their case. And as you mentioned, experts are saying that it would indeed be unconstitutional not to allow more witnesses. They need four Republicans, and there have been some who have been indicating, and Susan Collins among them, that they would vote for witnesses, However, we can expect behind the scenes some real strong-arm tactics on the part of the Republican Party and on the part of the Trump administration to avoid that from happening. So it remains to be seen. Trump is very nervous about John Bolton testifying. On Thursday, he issued some 140 tweets in all, which apparently is a record for him. And everybody knows that John Bolton was upset over the Ukraine deal as national security advisor and likened it to a drug deal. The biggest image that's come out of all this, especially with the issue of the witnesses, is if Donald Trump says he's not hiding anything, why is he so nervous about this? He's even threatened in Davos to use executive privilege to block testimony from witnesses, and particularly from John Bolton. And his quote there was, well, you don't like people testifying when they didn't leave on good terms. So he's afraid of something that Bolton could say there. Trump has been blocking this, and so today's case on the obstruction of justice will be interesting, with claiming absolute immunity. And now again threatening executive privilege on some of the issues. And this has led one federal judge to say presidents are not kings. Again, we're going back to how far the U.S. public will allow an executive to take over powers that belong to other branches and that were not established in the founding, in the Constitution itself, although there's a lot of space there for interpretation, which is one of the reasons that the precedent is the precedent settings here would be so important. Right. The Democrats, the strategy now that for saying that it doesn't take an actual crime to establish abuse of power, I think is a good one. We have Dershowitz, Trump's lawyer, on video saying that no crime is needed, which could be very embarrassing for him. But the defense of Biden part is probably a mistake, because it's not really the point, you know. Yeah. It's not the point of what the reason was behind why he pressured a foreign government to take up an investigation solely for his own personal reasons and then withheld aid on it. The reason is really not the gist of what this is all about. It's the misuse of power.
Right. And thank you for that, Laura Carlson. And Jackie Goldberg, I mean, on that Biden point, just picking up on that, I mean, one has to think that they're not raising Biden as a witness, really. I mean, although they may go for it, but also they just want to point to some impropriety on the part of Biden and his son to really underscore that. And Biden keeps having to defend his son. But also, I wonder, Jackie Goldberg, what do you think about how the House managers are doing, how they're making the case? And do you think that was the right team? And also, your views on if no witnesses are called, how legitimate will this trial seem to the general public? Or will it really matter to Trump's Republican base? And who knows if it'll impact independents? Jackie Goldberg.
Let's start with the end. Okay. It won't matter much to his base. But I am struck by the fact that 69% of the Republicans polled in a recent poll want witnesses and want evidence. So I think that, you know, I think all of us in America have seen one too many series of court trials or movies about court trials, and we all know that you have witnesses at a trial. And so this is part of why I think the Republicans are so perplexed by the fact that every poll shows a greater and greater percentage of Americans who want this to be a real trial. And I think that's the only positive thing about what's going on right now. I think that the Democrats have done a very superb job. I do believe what I think the Republican Kennedy said the other day, that, well, actually, we were all busy and most of us didn't watch what happened in the House, so a lot of us are seeing all of this for the first time. I think that's very important. I think it's also very important that everybody has to hear the kind of statement that shifts closed with yesterday about that right matters, that it matters whether or not a president can do whatever he wants. You know, I think the big question here, and it is the question not just for this president, but for all future presidents, is if you can in fact say you don't get anybody to testify, because we're calling it all our decision to have executive privilege, and you don't get any documents, and you don't get any help, it says that, in fact, the notion that there is a separation of powers and the balance between the three powers is gone. And that, of course, leads to a king or a despot of one sort or another and not a president that is guided by rules of law. And that's probably the long-range, really big threat of this whole thing, because we know pretty for certain that nobody's going to vote to get rid of Trump, even if they decide in their heart of hearts that what he did was wrong and impeachable, because all of them are terrified. And I take Lindsey Graham as the best example. Lindsey Graham, who used to be one of the people you could depend on in the House, in the Senate, rather, to more or less stand for some principles. Well, I think he has finally figured it out. He knows that if he is not 100% behind this president, he will no longer be in the United States Senate. He is up, and they will run against him, and they will knock him off, and he knows it, and he's terrified. And so he will do absolutely anything to protect this president in order to take care of himself. And that's basically what's going on here. We have Republicans who know better, who understand the implications of what they're doing, and not only have they joined Trump in putting themselves ahead of the country, but they know that everybody else that is in their party will do the same. And that's really the real danger of this president, is his cult-like following of about 38% to 40% of Americans. That cult-like following is a very dangerous thing. And if nobody remembers the 30s in Germany, when Hitler was elected, he didn't seize power, he was elected. He started killing, literally murdering his opponents, and nobody rose to stop him, because all those who could rise, that's not true, nobody did, a lot of people did, but those who rose to stop him themselves were killed. And as long as the general population is willing to let this president do whatever he wants by not taking him out in this next election, this whole business will have been really for naught.
Thank you, Jackie Goldberg. And Bill Gallegos, your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, well, thank you, Margaret. I think the impeachment is one new demonstration of how the Republican Party, one of the major parties of our ruling class, has been totally captured by the new Confederacy, the most right-wing elements of the party. And I think that echoes what Jackie is saying, is that none of them want to dare stand up to this kind of rabid right-wing social base that has now become at the heart of this party. I think that the Democrats, I believe, are aware that this whole exercise is ultimately not going to lead to impeachment and the removal of the president. But I think they're smart in that they realize that for a lot of folks, a lot of people in the public, still want to believe that the system can work. You know, they remember in Wall Street when all those Wall Street bankers and hedge funds tanked the economy and everybody walked away with subsidies and big payouts. And so there's a lot of cynicism. But I think there's still a lot of people that are hoping that the system will work. And I think that, for example, when Hakeem Jeffries presented a very factual, very detailed, very analytical case for calling witnesses, for having the president's staff testify, it was very, very persuasive, I think, to most folks that are just, you know, does this, you know, can we get anywhere with this or not? Or is this just a partisan political activity? So I think there's a value to this. And I think there's also a value to poking the bulldog. I think there's a realization that Trump will go crazy, which he's doing. He'll get out there. He'll do some very outrageous stuff as this thing moves forward. And I don't think that's to the benefit of anyone but his base. And his base is not going to move no matter what he does. But I think for other folks who are still concerned about what's going on, I think this will have an impact that could be positive. So So I think there's a lot for this that's really important. In terms of, you know, this argument about, well, you know, they're letting Giuliani call the shots. I mean, I think they should take that much farther. He's letting Ralph Reed call the shots, Stephen Miller, Stephen Bannon, you know, racist white nationalists call the shots, the NRA call the shots. Mm. So I think in terms of who are the folks that Trump listens to that are setting the direction of this country and being followed by those in the Senate and many of his federal judicial appointees, it's a much more dangerous cabal than Rudy Giuliani. And I think it's really important. I think this is one of the things that a lot of people are disappointed about, is that they narrowed this impeachment to these two items when there's so many things. You know, you have children dying in cages. How is that not a misuse of power? So I think there's what we've got. And, you know, I think I understand why the Democrats would feel they want to get out in front of the Biden thing. Get out in front and not then have to make them react, make the Republicans react, and not be on the defensive on this issue. So I think there's been some really actually smart approaches to this on the part of the Democrats that are presenting this case.
Right. Thank you, Bill Gallegos. And if I could just offer a little advice to the managers. I mean, I think that the clips that they're using from the House have been very effective. I also think using the polling data and connecting that with what Trump was doing, the demands he was making on Zelensky when Biden was shown to be beating him hands down, is also very effective. But I wish they say they're talking to the public. Sometimes they get into just talking to each other in the Senate, and I wish they would stop using acronyms every other sentence. The DOD and the OMB, etc. I mean, people kind of lose track of it. Just say it. It's just going to take a second to say Office of Budget and Management or Department of Defense. So that's something I think they need to clean up a little bit. But yeah, very insightful analysis by all three of you. What we're going to do now, though, we're going to switch gears to a related topic, though, talking about dominance in the Americas. We're going to be discussing the Organization of American States and its influence, impact in Latin America and the Caribbean, destabilizing mainly, and also the environmental catastrophe, some referring to it as a crisis. Our panelists will stay with us, but we'll take a short station break. We'll be right back.
You tell me to forget that my grandmother was born right there, so all right, I say I shall go. You tell me to forget. It is there I want my own children to grow. All right, I say I shall go. But I hope you understand how I feel.
And that is Emerton by the Bajan, the Barbados musician, the mighty Gabby. And when you hear the next segment, you will understand the connection with this song as the Caribbean region fights for its own sovereignty and to remain independent of being pushed around by the United States. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott, and our handle on Instagram and Twitter at SoTrueRadio. Check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. We keep a community calendar there, video and other information as well. And we're also around the nation and around the world on SoundCloud. And today, in our tradition, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Hampton, Virginia. And internationally, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Trinidad and Tobago. This is your host of Sojourner Truth, Margaret Prescott. It is our weekly roundtable, and our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Bill Gallegos. Now, the Organization of American States was founded in April of 1948, and Article 1 of its charter stated, quote, the goal of the member nations in creating the OAS was to achieve an order of peace and justice, to promote their solidarity, to strengthen their collaboration, and to defend their sovereignty, their territorial integrity, and their independence, end of quote. Among its eight essential purposes, they included respect for the principle of non-intervention, cooperative action to promote economic, social, and cultural development, to eradicate extreme poverty, to limit conventional weapons, to make it possible to devote the largest amount of resources to the economic and social development of the member states. Now, the roots actually of the OAS go back to Simon Bolivar, the liberator of Latin America, and Jose de San Martin. They had the idea of an international union in the New World. And in 1826, a Congress of Panama was held and attended by a number of countries in the region. But from the start, OAS founded in 1948, fast forward a bit here, the United States has seen the body as its own vehicle to dominate economic and social policy in the region, an idea stemming from the infamous Monroe Doctrine of the United States, where the U.S. basically operates as seeing itself as in charge of and dominate the region with the right to impose its policies. And this then has implications for people living in the United States and paying taxes also in the United States. Now, example, in particular, the U.S. has tried to use the OAS to undermine left-leaning governments in the region. Examples of this are numerous, from the exclusion of Cuba as a member of the OAS, its votes against the governments of the Bolivarian Revolution of Venezuela, against Evo Morales, the ousted president of Bolivia, its support for the criminal and brutal government of Jovenel Moise of Haiti, just to name a few. Now, the OAS, under the leadership of its Secretary General Luis Almagro, also worked to undermine ALBA, and we'll hear a little bit about that, I'm sure. Laura and others would want to weigh in on that, the alliance of governments in the region created by the late Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, and it was had served as a counterweight to the OAS. But the leadership of Almagro is up. There's going to be a vote in March of 2020. Elections will be held. And there is a move in the region, including in the Caribbean region, against his reelection. And this battle over the leadership of the OAS was in part of the context in a recent dust-up between several Caribbean nations and the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo just in the past days. And the U.S. bid to secure Almagro's re-election, because after all, he does their bidding, as well as to gather support for the U.S. position on Venezuela and U.S. control over the OAS. He has launched a tour of Latin America and the Caribbean. And on Wednesday, January 22nd, Pompeo was in Jamaica to meet with members of the Caribbean community known as CARICOM. But little Barbados, my home country, our first woman prime minister, Mia Mottley, objected. She also serves as the chairperson of CARICOM. She spoke out against the meeting and announced that the Barbados foreign minister would not attend. She accused the U.S. of attempting to divide CARICOM and quoted Errol Barrow, the first prime minister of Barbados following independence, who said, quote, we are friends to all, but satellites to none. And a sizable portion of the Caribbean community has rallied along the Barbados prime minister. But some did attend the meeting with Pompeo, including, no surprise, Haiti, the Bahamas, Belize, the Dominican Republic, St. Kitts, Nevis, and St. Lucia, and of course, Jamaica. So we're going to be discussing the OAS and its role. And Laura Carlson, let's start with you. I did have to give our listeners who may not be familiar with the body some background and history of it. But Laura Carlson, just fast forward now and talk about the implications of the fight for leadership within the OAS and the role that the OAS is now playing. Laura Carlson.
The OAS has historically, as you mentioned, been a proxy in some ways for U.S. interests. But in this case, and in recent years, Luis Almagro, as a Secretary General, is by far the most blatant and dangerous promoter of U.S. hegemony in the region and a new Cold War in the Western Hemisphere in recent history. We can look quickly at some of the cases, some of which you mentioned. They not only supported, but they actually orchestrated the coup in Bolivia last November by questioning the elections and spurring on an opposition that, as we know, overturned the elected government and is reinstating a racist and conservative ultra-right regime in Bolivia now. They, at the same time, have been virtually silent on the murder of young people protesting in Chile, several who have been assassinated, and more than 300 who have lost their eyes as a result of government repression there. They formed the Lima Group to try to overturn the presidency of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela and dividing the region between not just left and right, but also nations who have a less interventionist approach to foreign policy and to regional unity within Latin America. Both Mexico and Peru have since broken ranks in important ways. And then the Caribbean is one of the most obvious examples of how this leadership within the OAS has been sowing division. They've undermined ALBA, as you mentioned, by supporting Guaido, the puppet leader of Venezuela, selected by the United States government. They contributed to the internal division with Haiti because Haiti had received a great deal of solidarity, especially in terms of subsidized oil from Venezuela, and is a partner country in the region. The breaking ranks by leaders within the island has been met with a great deal of respect among many countries that are getting tired of this situation, and now they feel that they are liable to be punished for coming out openly and saying no to the re-election of Almagro in the OAS. Antigua, Barbuda, St. Vincent and Grenadines have already formally said that they are not supporting Luis Almagro to be the Secretary General and will be supporting another candidate. There are likely to be other countries doing this as well, and the ability to avoid the re-election of Almagro, although the organization will always have a preponderance of influence by the United States because it's the main funder and obviously the superpower of the region, will be fundamental in terms of whether democratic movements and fights against repressive governments and for the rule of law can progress in the future within Latin America.
Yes, thank you for that. And Bill Gallegos will actually go to you next. And by the way, Almagro, he's running against two candidates, the Ambassador Hugo de Zela Martinez, the permanent representative of Peru to the OAS, and Maria Fernando Espinosa of Ecuador, who was the former president of the United Nations General Assembly for the 73rd session. But Bill Gallegos, your thoughts on the OAS and its role.
Thank you, Margaret. And I have to say that Laura has written some of the most, I think, perceptive and thoughtful articles about the OAS. I mean, Almagro is just reprehensible. His own party unanimously kicked him out because he was so bad, because of his role in the OAS. I mean, he's just reprehensible. But the OAS, it does have a really tarnished history going back, I think, from the beginning, but thinking about 1965, when they supported the U.S. invasion of Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, when they had elected a populist president, Juan Bosch, who said, you know, we're going to take back control of our country. We're no longer going to just allow foreign interests to run our country, especially the United States. And the United States sent in the Marines, and they invaded and overthrew his government, which is one of the reasons, actually, why we have a larger Dominican population here in the U.S., because a lot of people had to leave. It was really brutal. And that's been the history. They expelled Cuba, as people know, from in 1959 up until 2009, when Cuba was readmitted to the OAS, and there was that famous photo of he and President Barack Obama and Raul Castro and President Obama and their famous handshake, which then led to some very positive changes in U.S.-Cuban relations until Trump was elected. So, yeah, there's this really horrendous history. The United States, of course, has took the policy of manifest destiny, which they applied to expand from coast to coast to steal Mexico's northern territories and to their slaughter of the U.S. wars against Native Americans. They took that south and have always seen from Mexico all throughout Latin America as their domain. And there's military bases, there's military contacts, there's the Office of the Americas. But the OAS has always been an important political tool for justifying U.S. intervention, whether it's economic, political, military, or a combination of those things. But I think there's changes. The changes in Mexico cannot be understated. That's extremely important. And I would say that what happened recently in Bolivia, the coup in Bolivia, was meant not only to overthrow the regime of Evo Morales, but to send a message to AMLO and the Morena party in Mexico. This is what could happen to you if you get too radical. So you better hold it in. So I think there's a lot going on here, but the story is not finished yet. And I think while the United States may feel they have things under control, there's a lot of activity still going on that is positive.
That's right. Thank you for that. And you're absolutely right about Manifest Destiny, the Monroe Doctrine, but also just this view of the United States that, well, we're just in charge of the region, not to mention the rest of the world. Jackie Goldberg, we will depend on you to kind of take us into the next section, our last section on the environment. And of course, the environmental crisis is also a major issue for the Caribbean islands in particular, but also for Latin America. So you likely have some thoughts on this, but what we'd like to do is to just play just a short clip of Greta Thunberg in Davos, the meeting of world leaders that recently wrapped up. Trump was there, but here's what she had to say on the environment to the leaders.
1 year ago, I came to Davos and told you that our house is on fire. I said I wanted you to panic. I've been warned that telling people to panic about the climate crisis is a very dangerous thing to do. But don't worry, it's fine. Trust me, I've done this before, and I can assure you it doesn't lead to anything. And for the record, when we children tell you to panic, we're not telling you to go on like before. We're not telling you to offset your emissions by just paying someone else to plant trees in places like Africa, while at the same time forests like the Amazon are being slaughtered at an infinitely higher rate. Planting trees is good, of course, but it's nowhere near enough of what is needed, and it cannot replace real mitigation and rewilding nature. And let's be clear, we don't need a low-carbon economy. We don't need to lower emissions. Our emissions have to stop if we are to have a chance to stay below the 1.5-degree target. This is not about right or left. We couldn't care less about your party politics. From a sustainability perspective, the right, the left, as well as the center have all failed. No political ideology or economic structure has been able to tackle the climate and environmental emergency and create a cohesive and sustainable world. Because that world, in case you haven't noticed, is currently on fire. You say children shouldn't worry. You say, just leave this to us. We will fix this. We promise we won't let you down. Don't be so pessimistic. And then, nothing. Silence. Or something worse than silence. Empty words and promises which give the impression that sufficient action is being taken. We demand at this year's World Economic Forum participants from all companies, banks, institutions, and governments immediately halt all investments in fossil fuel exploration and extraction, immediately end all fossil fuel subsidies, and immediately and completely divest from fossil fuels.
All righty. And Jackie Goldberg, I mean, linking these two things here, what we discussed before about the OAS and the Manifest Destiny Monroe Doctrine. Of course, the Monroe Doctrine, the U.S. was warning European powers not to interfere in the Western Hemisphere, but in so doing, establishing itself as the dominant power in the Western Hemisphere, including south of the border in the Caribbean. But Jackie Goldberg, your thoughts on this? I mean, we heard what Greta had to say, and just even the last couple of days, we've heard about the Trump rollbacks on the environment. We know the threat to the islands in the Caribbean, but along the coast and so much, not only of the U.S., but of the world. But nevertheless, you know, things seem to be moving along business as usual. Jackie Goldberg.
Well, you know, Davos has this notion, it says, that it's going to change the world for the better. But, you know, they had a survey that was taken there that 56% of people globally now believe that capitalism does more harm than good. And 50% of those surveyed said, the system is failing me. 31% said that business would pay a decent wage. Only 31% said, yeah, maybe they would. But 82% said it was a duty of the business. Oxfam released a report that said 2,153 people have more money than the poorest 4.6 billion people in the world. And so when we expect corporations to take seriously climate change, when they're making so much money on not taking it seriously, I think it's extraordinary. You had 100 billionaires come to this event, most of them arriving by private airplanes. So what does that tell you about their commitment to the environment? They come in private airplanes to talk about how wonderful they are in fighting climate issues. I mean, basically, it's a billionaire. I mean, you could tell from the beginning that this was a joke this year because they had Trump as one of the opening speakers. I mean, really, this is a guy who is a climate crisis denier, and he's the opening speaker or one of the opening speakers. So this whole World Economic Forum, it was, you know, billionaires having a nice time in a ski resort in Switzerland and talking to each other about what great guys they are. And it was mostly guys, about 76% men. And they have these wonderful reports. And then they have also a workshop on tax avoidance while they're supposed to be talking for businesses to pay greater taxes. I mean, It not only is a joke, but it is a joke of the worst kind because it says that basically the wealth of the world does not give a damn about the world in the future. It only cares about its profits right now.
Right. And Bill Gallegos, we'll go next to you. Sadly, we only have a couple of minutes left. No, Jackie, nothing to do with you. But just our other previous segments took the time that it needed. Bill Gallegos, your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, when you I agree with what Jackie was saying. This is a pretty, shameful exercise that goes on in Davos. And I think it reminds me of what the great eco-feminist climate justice leader from India, Vandana Shiva, has said, that we have to make a radical change in order to save the planet. So this idea of zero net emissions, lowering carbon emissions, get down to 50%, is not going to make it. As long as we have an economic system that is imperialist and is based on endless accumulation, with huge elements of racism and patriarchy that sustain this system, we're going on a suicide march. We're going over the cliff. So the change we need, there are immediate changes we need to make a just transition to go to clean energy. But ultimately, this system is not sustainable. It's destroying all the fisheries. It's destroying the ocean. It's destroying the arable land that we need to, for our food supply. It's destroying our air, and it's burning up the planet. So we really need to look, I think, at what Naomi Klein, Vandana Shiva, Joel Covell, and others have said. We need to look at a transformative project if we're going to save the world. And there's no getting around that. We can't mince words. We can't use euphemisms. We have to have a fundamental change in the kind of political economic system we have, or we will not survive.
Yeah, and Laura Carlson, I'm sorry you have a short thrift here, but I wanted to you to just say a little bit about the Indigenous leadership in all of this, because even in Australia, the lands under control of the Aboriginal, the First Nations people, they have not burned because they have been using the traditional practices. I know that you have spent time in Chiapas and other places. I wonder if you could just give us a few seconds of your thoughts on this, but then we'll have you on again to talk about this. Laura Carlson.
The leadership throughout the world where there are parts of the earth that are best conserved has been among Indigenous peoples. And their leadership is not only because they live in those areas that are so critical to the survival of the planet, but because they have been the stewards of those areas and represent a different set of values. One of the first messages, almost unanimously, is that the fight to save the planet has got to be against capitalism, as was mentioned. And another is that the patterns of consumption that were many of us guilty of, and the principle of profit that we saw in Davos, with the leaders essentially debunking Greta Thunberg and the entire youth movement of millions who have been fighting, is one of the greatest threats.
Right. Well, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much. Another fascinating roundtable. I also want to say we cannot forget the war that we almost got into with Iran. The threat still remains in the region. And this Saturday, January 25th, there'll be a global day of protest for our listeners in Southern California. People are gathering at 1 p.m. in downtown Los Angeles. For our listeners in other cities, you can go to UNACPeace.org to find actions in your area. It's been endorsed by a large number of organizations and saying we want peace, we don't want war. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank all of our panelists and our audio engineer today, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to PacificaRadioArchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. I hope you get to do something really nice this weekend.